Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
Time for another exciting new show here on Siren Radio, and launched very fittingly, of course, with Ralph Coates' theme to the Dam Busters there. Fittingly, because, of course, RAF Scampton, just away from Lincoln University, was where the Dam Busters obviously launched their successful expedition back in the day. So what is this new show, you might well ask? Well, it's not my show. Obviously, it is the wonderful Sound and Director's Vision, but let's call it Sound and Graham's Vision, because we have Ace, award-winning director with us, big friend of Siren Radio over the years, and indeed other stations, including Southside Broadcasting as well, the wonderful Graham Harper. Graham, welcome to your show.
Hello, Alex. Nice to be here. Yeah, very good.
Well, we've talked for years about getting together behind the turntables, and it obviously took a pandemic for us to finally develop this thing and actually put you into control from that point of view. So it's good, which you have total control of the music and various other things. And let's start off straight away with what we've just heard at the start of this programme, a very iconic piece of music. Ralph Coates, of course, known for a whole range of film scores from the 1955 motion picture, of course, with such delights as Michael Redgrave as Barnes Wallace, and, of course, the inimitable Richard Todd. Even these days, with a little disclaimer for people who actually need to acknowledge the fact that some of the language that's used in Dam Busters is appropriate to the time, but certainly inappropriate for the 21st century. I won't mention anything else. Suffice it to say, all to do with, Richard Todd's dog. But that's another line entirely. Graham, yeah. The key thing is, why was this particularly significant in terms of your first choice of music to launch the first of a whole new series?
Well, so I was brought up in Boreham Wood in Hertfordshire, which was the Hollywood of England. I mean, there's Pinewood and Shepperton and Denham and whatever, but in the 50s and obviously through the 20s and 30s, when Boreham Wood studios were developed, it was Hollywood. There were five or six major studios there, one of which being ABPC, who I think made the Dam Busters. So I was brought up from the age of about three in Boreham Wood, and I went with my father from the age of five to about the age of 12, 13. Every week we saw four movies, two movies in every show we went to. So during that time I saw probably 1,800 films. There was no way I was not going to have something to do with the film business in some way, or television, which is what I got. That's where I ended up. So I was kind of engrossed in movies and loved it and loved that world. And also I was in Boreham Wood. One of the things that really hit me around about 10 years old, I was going to drama school. I left the ordinary school I went to, junior school, to go to drama school. And I started there in the same year that this film came out, The Dam Busters. The British were always engrossed for some reason during those, and still to this day, in making films about the Second World War. And so as a 10-year-old, I went with my father to see this film, and it really, really affected me in a good way. And I found it exciting. I still find it exciting to watch. And I was very aware that these young guys, who were obviously much older than I was at 10 years old, but these were 19, 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds, probably being led by a 25-year-old, going to war, flying at night across Europe to bomb the big reservoir, the dams on reservoirs, in order to cause a huge amount of destruction to armament factories and whatever. And it was very, very dangerous. Every trip they did, they had flak flying at them from all the different gunneries all across Europe that the Germans had to attack these the enemy planes. So it was terribly frightening, and at the same time, really, really exciting and tense to watch. And it's lived with me all my life. And every time I hear that piece of music, I remember that film and those images, which were so vivid. It's a fantastic movie, and I wish everybody a chance to see it. It will affect you, hopefully in a good way, because it's very heroic.
And it is interesting insofar as clearly 1955, just 10 years, a decade after the end of the Second World War, so very much within living memory of a whole range of individuals. And it's interesting now when one watches it, and I think this is one of the blessings of technology, that you can actually see the thing in wonderful crystal clear, black and white monochrome digital quality. It's impossible for me, because I'm not around at the time, to actually talk about what it was like seeing it in the cinema on a wide screen and so on. I mean, presumably it was traditional projector film, 35mm sort of delivery. But it's still interesting in terms of, for me, it's the characterizations that really work. The character, as I said, Michael Redgrave as Barnes Wallace. And the first half hour of the movie, which I would have thought for a young soul, 9, 10 year old, might have been really quite challenging to actually that first half hour, which is very much a case of how Barnes Wallace feels as though he's being knocked back, or he's trying to come up with this idea for what we then sort of know is the bouncing bomb, etc. And we get introduced to people like Palmer Harris, and we see obviously Richard Todd as Guy Gibson. And it's interesting that people were saying there that Guy Gibson in reality wasn't anywhere like as gregarious or as charming as Richard Todd made him out to be. He was very much a loner who just got on with the job. Well, I suppose, you know, the film was always working through that. And yet, as I say, there's something that does continue to echo across the years in terms of the significance of that. Just going back to the piece of music, do you think that Coates was particularly impressive in really tapping into that? Because it's inevitable that once you actually hear those opening bars, you kind of recognise it as that's the theme to the Dam Busters.
I think it's really interesting. I think all the composers I've worked with up till now, all of them, to a man and woman, all of them watch the product that they're going to write the music for, the background music or the opening titles or whatever, and really, really get into the atmosphere and the feeling and the characterizations of the various characters in the films. They even create themes for those characters. So when a particular person will walk in, it could be romantic, could be dramatic, whatever. They really get into the character of the whole film so that the music really does, is influenced by those characters, as opposed to they write a piece of music and then we make a film and then the film is made to the feeling of the music. It's the other way around. And I find that really interesting. So, yeah, it was, I think in that film, the grim determination of Barnes Wallace to absolutely persuade and make them understand and overcome all the difficulties he had was extraordinary. And I think the music, the background music in the film also gives that feeling. That's what I love. That's what I love about composers. When you work with them closely, as you do, the emotion that you both talk about and you want to get on the screen is terrific. It's a fantastic journey to go on.
Indeed, as this series continues, I think we'll actually sort of explore some of that aspect. But that's the musical of Ralph Coates. I'm intrigued by your thoughts regarding two Michaels in particular, Michael Anderson, the director, and of course, Michael Redgrave, part of obviously what is really the Redgrave dynasty now in terms of the whole essence. I mean, it's always difficult to find a kind of impact with the maybe the Cusacks. I mean, I don't know, in terms of a family that kind of really echoed in terms of cross stage and screen, etc. But I would have thought that as a 10-year-old, you really paid no attention whatsoever to the director. Looking at some of the things that Michael Anderson also came up with, Around the World in 80 Days, Summer of the Monkeys and so on, and also somebody who actually started off as an office boy at Elstree back in the day and actually sort of progressed by 1938 up to becoming assistant director and so on. Do you look now, and let's look at it from the point of view of the Graham Harper of the 21st century, do you look back when you see the Dam Busters and think, do you know, that was a really good shot? I mean, I was really intrigued in terms of looking at the way in which the testing is going out. And actually, there is a kinetic energy that Anderson seems to have actually put into the shots. It's not really a static movie. I mean, some shots are in the opening start, but it does actually move along at quite a pace.
Oh, yes. No, I think... Yeah. He really... No, sorry, I'll start again. As a young boy, I wasn't necessarily aware of... I'm not sure that's not true. I was aware of things. I didn't think, that was a good shot. I didn't think in those terms. But, for example, when I hear that music, the images I have, there are two images that come to... there are three. Bouncing bomb at night to hit a target. That's an extraordinary feat in its own right. A close profile shot, I now know it's called, of Richard Todd as the skipper, leading the six or seven Lancaster bombers into attack, etc. Close shots of them, and they were done statically. They were in a studio somewhere, but you feel you're up in the air with them. flying. That's a clever feat to do, with a man sat in a made-up cockpit on a static kind of rig somewhere against black. And yet the effects that you get from that, and I remember that. That's what I remember very clearly. So that's a shot. But I didn't know it and didn't think, oh, gosh, that was a good shot. I do now, but then I just thought, that vision of that man is how I saw it. Mm-hmm. Tense, excited, nervous and worried about both his team and what they're about to do. But no, you're right. I didn't think in terms of shots. Michael Anderson's a terrific director. I mean, he's a big name. He's almost a forgotten name.
Mm. Yeah, not to be confused, I think there is another American Michael Anderson who directed The Andromeda Strain and Logan's Run and so on. I don't think they're the same. I'm fairly certain they're not.
No, they're not.
We just clarify that. And we mentioned the other Michael, of course, Michael Redgrave, but that also leads me into the other aspect. What about the performances? Because this is really at that interesting time before we've got into the notion of method acting, before we get into the whole notion of new angry young men acting, the kind of line of look back in anger and various other things. This is still very much kind of a British film with British approaches. And looking at, shall we say, Ursula Jean's performance as Mrs. Wallace, Basil Sidney as Air Chief Marshal Bomber Harris, as we mentioned, Derek Farr, lots of names that, even if we don't recognise the names, we kind of, they become, they're icons of a certain kind of Britishness. Did that impact your good self, or did you identify with the heroic character of Guy Gibson and the fact that it was being portrayed by Richard Todd was irrelevant?
I was a child, I was a war baby. So during the early 50s, from 1945, I mean, I don't remember 1945 when I was born, but I suppose my first memories are about 1948, 49. There was a big bad winter at one stage. I'm just quickly telling you this because I'm setting a scene. Bournemouth had a little church hall and had a community centre, etc., which, whenever you saw these movies, those centres still existed, or the clubhouses, or the Elstree Aerodrome, which is a little aerodrome that I think Spitfires operated out of during the war. Whenever I went to those places for a Tay dance as a later child, as it were, a later 7 or 8 year old with my mum and dad, there were people who talked terribly frightened like that. And hello, boy, and jingoes. They had this kind of dialogue that was antiquated. And sometimes you hear it now with some elderly people who are of that period. I think what defines the artists in those films is the actors concerned are at the height of their talent and were at the height of their talent and wanted, because they were the top class actors of their day. And they weren't heightened, and they were absolutely true, I think. Most of those characterizations were real and true. That's how people spoke, that's how they were, and they did have the stiff upper lip and didn't show too much emotion, old boy, and what, which we find slightly odd now and terribly heroic, but not quite so true. But I think it was. I think that was the way people spoke and the way people were. I think they were top class actors. I was convinced, and by all the performances, I'm sure there were some over the top characters, in the smaller parts. But I think Michael Redgrave, I don't know what he was like as a fellow actor. I have no idea whether he was pleasant to work with or not. I have no idea. But his acting of that character was lovely. He was a lovely guy who was desperately trying to convince everyone that this would work.
And I suppose very interesting, because literally because it was within living memory, many of the people who were involved with the project would have still been alive. So again, they would have commented on screen in terms of, was that accurate? Was that appropriate?
Absolutely.
I think we tend to think nowadays when people talk about, let's do a dramatization about Dominic Cummings, let's do a dramatization about COVID-19 or various other things. And we think, oh, it's far too soon. The Crown, of course, another one that is sort of there. But actually there has been a history in terms of film in particular of actually doing if not docudramas, but certainly representations of what's been happening, etc. Because, as you say, they are great stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
We move on from 1955, 2 years down the line, and a slightly longer movie, not 120 minutes with respect to the joys of the Dam Busters, but 161 minutes, so literally just 20 minutes under 3 hours, in a movie that's actually based on a screenplay by a Frenchman, Pierre Boulle, who, of course, would go on to write Planet of the Apes on Monkey Planet back in the day. Le Pont de Rivière Quai, the title, excuse my French accent, sorry, Graham. But The Bridge on the River Kwai, another adventure and drama scenario classified as destined to become a classic at the time, well, I think it has been, and a magnificent moving film. William Holden, of course, Alec Guinness and Jack Hawkins. We're going to hear in a few moments the Colonel Bogey March from Bridge on the River Kwai. But is this, I mean, the big difference, obviously, from my point of view, and I would have thought from yourself as well, and we didn't talk about this with respect to Dam Busters, is Dam Busters black and white, Bridge on the River Kwai, total colour. Now, I remember my experience of cinema, my first experience of cinema in the late 60s, as being the wow factor where you actually see something that you'd previously seen in black and white on television in colour. In that case, it was Batman. But, you know, that was a different sort of system where you see that sort of colour. Were you thinking about issues relating to colour? And again, just go back to Dam Busters. Do you think that works almost better in black and white than it would have done in colour?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think it was definitely a film of its time. I think the atmosphere in the black and white movie was extraordinary. And of course, you know, as a young boy, I went to see lots of American Westerns which were in colour. There were massive colour films in those days.
Cinema had to fight back against television. I had to come up with something, so why not bring colour in?
Absolutely. No, I think the Dam Busters wouldn't have been improved by being in colour because it was at night. Most of the action was taken at night in terms of all the action of the planes flying across Europe. They certainly weren't going out to bomb the dams during the daylight. So the atmosphere was created brilliantly by being in black and white. There's Bridge on the River Kwai. Now you can feel the heat. When you watch that film, it is set in a... You can feel the humidity and the awful situation. Both the Japanese soldiers themselves also were in because they were having to keep guard of these people. They weren't very pleasant to the British troops, but they weren't actually living a fantastic life in the jungle themselves. And I think by being in colour, you get all that. You get the sweaty, heat, humid, horrible conditions they were all living in, as it were. What I find interesting is that the music for this film and the music in the film is terrific. But Colonel Bogey was composed by a man called A.J. Ricketts. And it's interesting how it was composed because, I mean, it was composed in 1914, so it wasn't the director, David Lean, going to... A.J. Ricketts saying, right, this is the movie, can you write me a lovely opening titles? It was established already as a military march by A.J. Ricketts. He wrote this song, piece of music, based, and it's interesting what happened. He played golf with, a person called Colonel Bogey. He was a golfing partner to this guy. And instead of yelling out four, when he hit a golf ball and it was going in the line of a bypasser in the distance and four was out, yelled out to warn somebody, you're going to be hit by my golf ball, mate. Instead of doing that, this Colonel Bogey went and every time he hit a ball that was destined to hit somebody on the head, he would do this whistle. And eventually A.J. Ricketts, this stuck in his head. And so he decided to create a piece of music that started, each line of the music started off with that sound. So that's how the song, the Colonel Bogey was created. So every line start, da-da, this whistle, da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. And of course, it then became a very rude song about Hitler and his cronies, etc., and blah, blah, blah. So it became quite famous. And it's lovely and evocative of the way it first is introduced, apart from being the opening title music as an orchestral piece or marching man, a band piece. The bit in the film that is memorable to me and is so defiant and terrific and typical of the way British soldiers were portrayed and still are to this day. You know, we're defiant, stiff upper lip, we're going to survive, we are going to be okay, is 200 or 300 men being transported, well, marching, they weren't being transported, they march probably for several hundred miles to a prison camp led by Japanese soldiers. And the first time you see them in this mass, you hear this whistling in the distance whilst you see other prisoners already there in this prison camp, in this hot, sweaty, horrible area of a jungle. And you see, you hear, and then you see 200 or 300 men whistling, some out of tune, it's pretty, but defiantly marching in to this camp. And then obviously the person in charge comes out and sees this, this defiant mob, and now he's got a big problem. How's he going to solve this one? And he's going to be very aggressive. He's going to solve it. And it's a fantastic piece of whistling, because all out of tune, it's all higgledy-piggledy as it would be with 200 men trying to keep in tune with each other. And then the band comes in and joins them, etc. It's a terrific piece of music, and it reminds me, every time I hear it or hear that, you know, when you watch military parades, somewhere along the line, that piece of music's played, I always remember that iconic sequence of these men with boots half falling off, dirty, filthy, dishevelled, but still marching defiantly into the camp. It's fabulous, a fabulous moment.
Listening to Sound and Director's Vision, And we've just been listening to the fabulous Malcolm Arnold score, of course, for Bridge on the River Kwai, with that wonderful introduction, as we talked about. We want to return briefly to that, Graham, in terms of the director once again. And I see that one of the things that David Lean actually had as a child was, as he was brought up as a strict Quaker, he wasn't actually allowed to go to the movies. So maybe that might have actually paid some kind of import in terms of why he kind of became such a great director. But clearly, he had cut his teeth with things like Brief Encounter in 1945, 12 years before Bridge on the River Kwai. There are other movies that we're going to talk about that he's been involved with that were also hugely cinematic. I always loved, I think, one of the aspects of his visuals that was very impressive was he always used to have this notion of lots of extras going in completely the opposite direction to one or two of the key characters, so that as the cinema would actually sort of reveal the sort of notion that your focus was on the people who were going against the crowd, quite literally and metaphorically in many instances. But in terms of Bridge on the River Kwai, again, was it something about David Lean's line that also maybe started sowing the seeds initially of thinking, this is really quite an impressive story that's being told here? Or was it a case of Alec Guinness, frankly, when he blows up the bridge at the end, spoiler alert, it's just it fitted in perfectly with respect to, again, this crazy notion of a war movie?
Well, no, what you've just said is not quite true. He doesn't blow the bridge up. He what's interesting about that film is the Japanese commandant wants him and all his officers to join the men in building. And it's essential that all the men build that bridge. And he says, my officers are not going to build that bridge. They are going to supervise it. They do not build it. They will supervise it under my supervision. All the men will do as we ask, and they will go as you want to build the bridge. But we will not build. We will supervise. And for that argument, he's put into a corrugated pit.
Isolation tank, basically.
Isolation hut, as it were, for days upon days, and is nearly killed by this. And he's left there. I think he does this several times in the book. And eventually, what happens in the film, he beats the Japanese mentality because he's so defiant, and he survives all that. And I think the commandant realizes he's met his match and has some kind of huge respect for Alec Guinness's character. And eventually, Alec Guinness and his troops and his officers and the commandant and his officers all join together, sit round a table and plan how they're going to make this fantastic, wonderful bridge as a piece of British ingenuity. And suddenly, Alec Guinness is almost in charge of the whole operation. So by the time we get to where the bridge is going to be destroyed by a group of people who are coming in, William Holden and his merry men, to wipe out this bridge. Alec Guinness, realising what's going to happen, he sees wires going to detonate. He wants to stop it because this is a marvellous piece of work that his troops, who've all suffered and people have died, to actually make. He's not on the side of the Japanese. He's on the side of the British ingenuity and talent and engineering, etc. So it's a strange, interesting. It's really weird, Alex. But for most of my young life as a young actor, and then wanted to become a director, I never really thought the early films of David Lean were great performances. That were led by him. I'm saying it the wrong way. There were some great performances, but I never felt he had much to do with that. He had actors by sufferance, I think. They're a necessary evil. He seemed to be more interested in the visuals and the actual drama of the shots that he was creating and left the actors to themselves. That's what I thought. But when you see that film and then when you subsequently look back at all the other movies, and then forward to the likes of Lawrence of Arabia, he was a terrific actor director. I'm sure lots of actors felt they were left on their own. Alec Guinness has actually said that he didn't feel he got tremendous. He didn't think he had a tremendous care from David Lean, that he was just there because he was a name. And I don't know. I don't get the impression they got on very well. And yet, fantastic performance. And Lee must have had something to do with that, because that's it's a fabulous film. And there are some wonderful performances.
And of course, they would go on to work together again in subsequent movies as well from that point of view. Had you started acting yourself at this time, Graham? Was it a case of you were already involved as a child actor by the time 1957 had rolled round? Or was it a case
of... Yes, I'd been at drama. I went to Italia Conti Stage School, which was a very prestigious drama school. And it had a huge amount of big stars that had come from that drama school. So I was in a good place as far as learning... the art of being an actor. So I had been there for 2 years by then. So I was now 12 years old. I was doing modern ballet. Well, a form of modern ballet. It wasn't modern ballet we know now. Dancing anyway, acting and singing. So music and all kinds of genre of music were, you know, given to me. And I gradually, I suppose, couldn't resist being, I was never a musician really, but I love music and I love the effect music has on productions, definitely in the theatre and then subsequently movies and film. But I mean, in the theatre, I realised the value and the importance of music. Although in music, unless you're doing music, in theatre, unless you're doing a musical, you don't have any music. There's no background music. Whereas in film and television, especially now, there is. There's lots of background music. But I learnt about music and the value of music at drama school, not because I thought I was going to become a director. I was going to become an actor, obviously, at that stage. When I saw... there's a film that I would love to talk about eventually, which made me realise I ain't going to be an actor. But it wasn't at this stage. So at this moment, I was going to be an actor. And I was very, and obviously at 12, 13 years old, I was beginning to understand, not shots, but the great movies, understand what made a great movie, because I love film, you can probably tell.
Well, again, I think that certainly comes across. And you mentioned music, of course. We've already looked at the work of Michael Anderson. We've considered David Lean. We'll come back to that. Up next, of course, it's Robert Wise, of course, who would, as well as having a solid connection with Orson Welles back in the day, was also the man behind The Sound of Music and Star Trek The Motion Picture and The Andromeda Strain. But this 1961 edition is so good, it's taken until relatively recently for Steven Spielberg to say, I'll remake that. The Crazy Soul, West Side Story. Why have you actually, I mean, is this something which were you taken along by Italia Conti to say, you're doing music at Italia Conti, you must see this? Was it a school trip? Because it's certainly, it does deal with conflict. It deals obviously with drama. It's loosely based on Romeo and Juliet, obviously. Is it one of those areas where you think, okay, fine. Where are the soldiers?
Listen, this, right. So this is now 1958, I think.
61?
No. Hold it. Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
No, you're absolutely right. 1961 was the film.
Yeah.
But my first being aware of West Side Story was in 1958, when there was a London production. The American production came to London in 1958. Yeah. Now, so by 1958, I'm now 13. I was doing ballet, a form of modern ballet, which was fairly formal. All the dance stuff we did was quite formal, and most musicals were quite formal in those days, more like the Tiller Girls, lots of Tiller Girl kind of routines.
Lots of high kicks.
I wasn't in love with dancing at that stage, because it was not very exciting to me.
Had you not seen Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire?
Oh, no. Excuse me. I'm talking about the theatre musicals, theatrical musicals of the day. No, I have to tell you, I think I know all of the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies and anything that Fred Astaire did. That's totally different. He was just unique and stunning, and all his partners were. They're totally different, and I totally agree. And of course, there were great American films of the 30s that were Busby Berkeley and all that. Wonderful. No, I'm talking about just after the war. There were some great musicals, but I didn't think much of the dancing, to be very, very honest. I'd be shocked for this, won't I? And then suddenly this stage musical came, or the American musical, West Side Story, hit London. And I went to see it with the school. There were about 22 of us all went on a matinee to see West Side Story. That changed everything. Oh, I'm getting excited. I'm being in the theatre, lots of us up in the gallery. We couldn't afford the best seats, so we were up in the gods, as they call them, looking down. We were so high up, looking down on the stage, quite a long way from it. And the band started up playing the overture. Oh, I can't tell you. I mean, I got goose pimples. It was exciting, the music. And it led, and then the opening music then led into the Jets song, and then we were off, and we were talking about hoodlums, your gangs in New York. I knew nothing about it beforehand. I suppose I was a bit ignorant. I didn't read anything about this musical other than it was the latest thing from America and had to be seen. Well, it had to be seen. And when we saw it, I just thought, well, that's the end of my dance. I mean, that's...
When you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out, let's get cracking.
Where you gonna find Bernardo?
It ain't safe to go into PR territory.
We're at the dance tonight at the gym.
Yeah, but the gym's neutral territory.
Hey, Rab, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-o.
So listen, everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony and me at the dance at the 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're jets.
The greatest.
When you're a jet, you're the top cat in town. You're the gold medal kid with the heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swingin'est thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king.
The jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clinking. The sharks will stay clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken.
Here come the jets like a bat out of hell. Someone gets in our way. Someone don't feel so well.
Here come the jets. Little world, step aside. Better go underground. Better run. Better hide. We're drawing the line. So keep your nose hidden. We're hanging a sign. So visitors forbidden. And we ain't kidding.
Yeah, and
we're gonna beat every last bugging gang on the whole bugging street, on the whole bugging ever loving street. Yeah.
Well, there's no way this is it. It changed everything. In fact, that musical changed musicals forever from that day onwards. From the day I saw that, every musical I went to see after that was stunning. All the dance routines were electrifying, led by this wonderful production. And eventually the film came out, and that was stunning. The aerial shots to start off with of New York, with the overture, and then you hear the whistling of the gangs, and then the camera zooms down into a playground and where a ball is being bounced around and whatever, and the gangers arrive and confront each other. It's so exciting. What an exciting production, both in theatre and then the film is stunning. The music is stunning. The dancing was electrifying. And modern jazz dance was here. Modern ballet had arrived big time. And it was so exciting that I say I gave up really wanting to be a dancer, but what happened was Italia Conti decided from that show onwards they were going to get in a modern ballet choreographer to do dance classes because they knew the game was up. We had to move forward. So we had a very exciting choreographer from I don't know where he came from. I think he was German. But he taught us routines that were stunning. And I really loved that. I loved the jazz dance, but I actually wasn't very good. So in the end, I did abandon that. But it moved them to get in really fantastic talent to train young dancers to become the future dancers of the theatres.
Music, of course, by Leonard Bernstein, who would go on to create a whole range of other factors and certainly connects very highly with West Side Story. Although I must admit, I would have possibly said that we mustn't neglect the work of Rodgers and Hammerstein and indeed things like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and South Pacific. I think there were some interesting dance routines in there as well, which if you're looking at, again, dancing in the movies, would probably be worth considering. West Side Story, though, I take your point, Graham, an interesting game changer. Astonishingly, we're coming to the end of the first episode of Sound and Graham's Vision, Sound and Director's Vision, and we have moved through two war movies and a West Side Story, a through line possibly being whistling, because obviously whistling in West Side Story, whistling in terms of Colonel Bogey, and I'm sure there are a few whistles in the Dam Busters back in the day. But we are now actually sort of at the closing one of this first episode, which takes us solidly into jazz with the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Thank you. Why have you gone for this one, Graham? Is it just you like the jazz? Is the jazz sort of soaking through the area? Is this a case of somehow Take Five is just quite phenomenal?
So I, as a young 10 or 11 year old, I became aware of jazz because I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg on a little crystal radio that I made. I think most kids did in those days. And I hid under the blankets in my bedroom late at night trying to listen to Radio
Commercials,
Luxembourg.
Commercials, Graham.
Yes.
The only way you could actually hear commercials on radio was going to Radio Luxembourg. No chance of BBC.
But what was interesting was along the way, I came upon by accident an American network radio force, an American forces radio network in Germany, and they were playing. I started listening to Basie and Duke Ellington, and some of the great jazz musicians of the 50s and 60s, early 60s. So I suddenly, as a young boy, found music that I really loved, which was jazz, and then eventually I got into R&B, and the rest is history. So I had an interest in jazz. 1958, I think it was, Dave Brubeck brought out this album called Take Five. And I think it changed the whole atmosphere of who loved jazz, because I think jazz was an acquired taste for most people. They felt it would belong to a different group of people. It didn't reach out to the whole world. Take Five did. Dave Brubeck Quartet in that album, Take Five, I think it was the highest selling jazz record of all time at that stage, definitely, and probably to this day. And it reached every quarter of the universe, really. And for good reason, because when you listen to the whole album, it is stunning. And Take Five, the actual track, is so memorable and cool, and has been used by many directors. Woody Allen used it in Mighty Aphrodites to be cool, and he's a jazz musician in his own right, and it touched him. He loved it, and I love it. When I was 17, I'd left drama school, and I was employed for a month as a page boy, unspeaking page boy, in a fashion show. I wasn't part of the fashion show. I was just standing to one side, showing in the models, which that was a very nice job. I heard they played that album as the background to the fashion show. So I heard that twice a day for 31 days. So I know every tune on that album backwards, forwards and sideways. I could almost play that if I could play an instrument. It's really ingrained in me, and it really consolidated my love for jazz and also the use of jazz in productions.
The magic of the Midweek Drive has embraced Zoom as wholeheartedly as it once did the minidisc. Truly, the 21st century has arrived.